Welcome, everyone. There are 28 people here. So cool. I was sure that because we have a Jukai ceremony later today that lots of people would be skipping. But let me go around and say hello to each person so we know who's here. Ellen? Bob O? Jason? Marvin? So-on? Phil? Richard? Matt? Claudia? Mary? Amelia? Mark. I have just one Mark here today, I think. So, Mark. Sam. Adine. Ruth Ann. Susan. Vin. Alvaro. Cinda. Oh, it's another Bob O. You're both Bob. No, wait. Bob K. Bob K and Bob O. I knew another Bob with an O last name. Pat, Jessica, Franklin, Coral. I've got to turn to the next page, reorient myself. All right, Paulette, Amanda, Doreen, and David. All right. Okay, so in terms of announcements, we actually have a few announcements. This afternoon, you can log on as early as 2, but the ceremony probably won't be starting until about 2:15, that is Pacific time. We'll be having our Jukai ceremony in the park, and we're going to do the best to give you 2 Zoom views, one of me, like kind of me and the people up by the altar, and one more of a big view. And I recommend that if you do log on, that you turn off your own video in order to not hog bandwidth. So minimize the video, except for Adine and Claudia, who will be hopefully participating and taking the precepts remotely. So at some point I will need to see you, but Sam is going to be our tech guru guide and will be instructing you. And that's about a 35 minute ceremony. So if you want to tune into that, we'll also be trying to record it. So you know, if you're not able to do that today, you might be able to see it anyway. It is kind of sweet to participate because it is, like people have pointed out, it's kind of like a renewal of our Jukai vows if we have taken the precepts ourselves before. And then next Sunday, the 19th, I will be giving a talk at just via Zoom. I'm going to be right here, but I will be at a local Unitarian Universalist fellowship. And in my place, Ryushin Creedon will be here giving the talk for you. And I asked him to send us a bio. So he sent this. Ryushin Hart is a Zen priest and social worker. He lived and trained for 9 years at Great Vow Zen Monastery with Chosen and Hogen Bay's Roshi. He was ordained in 2005. Ryushin completed Dharma transmission in 2019 with Tenku Ruff Osho in the Harada Dayun Sogaku Roshi lineage. That's in Japan. Ryushin completed his social work education through Boston University and provides mental health, addiction, and trauma counseling in Corvallis, Oregon. And Ryushin is passionate about Buddhism, social justice, shame resilience, and nurturing all life to grow to its greatest potential. So I don't know what he's going to be talking about yet, but I think he's going to send me a little blurb for the newsletter this week. And then the week after that, so we'll have 2 guest speakers in a row. The week after that, Joshin will be doing our talk. So many of you know her. She's a Dharmarain priest and the head priest out at Y East Zen Center, and she's participated in our session that for 3 years at least were annual until this year. Actually, we had decided to postpone our session until March 2021 because we needed to change venues, and that's what worked out. So that's kind of just kind of worked out in terms of the pandemic that we actually weren't planning to do a session this year. Anyway, any other announcements people can think of that I should be making? Sam?
For this afternoon, I did post some instructions for how to adjust your Zoom for a better experience in the Google group for Brightway Zen members. If you're not a member and planning to watch, post your email in the chat and I'll pick it up and I can email them directly to you if you're interested. If you don't make changes in Zoom, you're just going to be getting my feed, but you will hear Domio's audio and the preceptees. But if you want a better experience, follow those instructions or email me and I'll send them to you.
Thank you, Sam.
That'll work for laptops. Laptops, I don't know if it'll work. I don't think it works for iPad or other small devices or phones. I think on that, you're just going to be stuck with my feed and listening to Domio through her audio.
And I think, right, the other way is like you can kind of split the screen so you can see both at the same time.
Correct.
Right.
You can make it side by side. There is a way to make Domio's the primary.
All right.
Thank you for all the work you've done, and Bob and Mark and everybody with this, because I know you were troubleshooting for a while yesterday after.
Yeah. and just, you know, like I've said to Claudia and Aideen, who are going to be trying to do this remotely, if they fall off, if the Zoom quits, you know, we'll just do another online version. So no heart attacks in the middle. You know, we have no idea if we're going to be able to pull it off, but we'll see. Yeah, I guess my nightmare is like there's too much for the bandwidth, and I start to go. we'll see. All right. So today's talk, I'm calling Giving Our Lives Direction, Shape, and Meaning, the Practice of Vow. Of course, because people are taking Jukai today, so it seemed appropriate. So I thought I'd start off by talking a little bit about what Jukai is in our lineage and what it means, and then go on to vow more generally. So, Jukai is the name of our ceremony of receiving the Buddhist precepts. And it's interesting. So the precepts are our moral guidelines for in Buddhism. And traditionally in Buddhism, there were five: do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality, do not lie, do not misuse intoxicants. We have 10. There's an additional five that get a little more subtle. But the idea is that we vow to follow these precepts as best we can, and this is the core of our practice. So when we say we receive the precepts, it's interesting because, I mean, they're just moral guidelines, right? You can decide they're good and you want to follow them. But there is a certain a tradition where, you know, the idea is that these precepts are precious teachings that are passed down from generation to generation. And I received them from someone, and I, because I trained as a teacher, I am empowered to give them to other people. So it's like the idea being that, you know, you need to train yourself enough in the tradition and what these things mean and the context and the teachings so that you can hand this tradition to someone in a full supported way. So that's what we say. Sometimes we say take Jukai, but it almost more is, you know, like you receive it. Like you can't go take the precepts. You receive them from someone who gives them to you. So there's something very sweet about that image of when we formally receive Jukai and vow to follow the precepts and formally become a Buddhist, then we're joining this lineage that goes all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha, as we recited today in our chanting, all the way down through India, China, Japan, and now America, through my teacher, and then through me. And it's totally optional in our lineage whether you want to take Jukai, receive Jukai. It's encouraged. It feels like when people receive Jukai, they kind of join the family in a way. You know, I mean, we don't exclude anybody who doesn't receive Jukai, but there's I don't know. It's showing up in that public way and saying, I want to be identified as part of this community is, you know, it's kind of encouraging to the rest of the community. And as many people ask, as they're about to receive the precepts, is like, I can't keep these perfectly. What, you know, do I have to really promise to sort of like not misuse intoxicants? Does that mean I never can have a beer? Like, I don't know that I can be completely honest all the time, never indulge anger. Some of our precepts are pretty subtle, right? Do not blame self or praise self or blame others. I mean, ever in your mind? So it's impossible to keep the precepts completely, perfectly. But the idea is, as I'm going to be talking about more today, is that we're taking them on as vows that will shape our life. So when people receive Jukai and formally become Buddhists, we give them a wagesa, which means a little kesa, a little robe. So this is a rakusu, which is a little bit bigger version. And the robe that I wear as a priest is the kind of full version, the okesa. So our garments, our ceremonial garments in Buddhism, are always a sign of our vows. We've taken particular vows, and that is why we wear this particular garment. So the wagesa, is anybody wearing one that they can raise up to the camera? There's Pat. There, Pat's wearing one. And then raise it up so we can see the knot. Yeah, so it's a strip of cloth, and then you can't see it in her thing, but it has a beautiful little decorative knot at the bottom. And in our lineage, there we go. Yeah. It's really tricky to make those knots too. And so we hand make those, and we give them to the preceptees. So in many lineages, when they do Jukai, they have people sew rakusus, and then they get a Dharma name. And in our lineage, we kind of separate that out a little bit, and receiving the precepts and Jukai to become a Buddhist and join this lineage and join the Sangha is one step. And then again, totally optional, is to become a formal student of a particular teacher, and that's when we do the Dharma name and rakusu. So more on that if anybody's curious. But so that's what folks will be doing today. So we will have, by the end of the day, 9 new Buddhists. To get more onto vow in general, vow is central in Buddhism. It gives shape to our lives. So that's the two key things. Vows give shape, direction. What else did I say? Direction, shape, and meaning to our lives. And the second thing is vows are about optional things. You don't make a vow to follow the law of gravity. I don't make a vow to be 5'2" high. That is irrelevant. Ironically, we make vows often about very serious things, but ultimately they are optional. They are a choice. This idea really came home to me when I was getting married for the second time. And the first time I had made vows, and then I had broken them. I had decided, no, I have promised to stay with this person and I don't want to do that anymore. That's not how I want my life to go, so I'm going to divorce them. And after that, it really undermined my own sense of my own integrity in a way. It's like, well, how can I vowed anything? I just broke them. I mean, like, what does it mean? I may passionately vow to do something, but I don't even take myself seriously anymore. So when I was getting to the point where I was going to get married for the second time, it was almost like I asked my husband, like, why, what's the meaning of my vow? If I'm vowing, oh yes, I'm going to vow to stay with you and support you through thick and thin, but I promised that to somebody else and I didn't follow through. And that's where, you know, he really pointed out, like, that's what vows are for. Vows are there because you might break them. Vows are there because this is a choice and an option. So they're never a guarantee. However, if we live without vows, if we live just based on how we feel each moment, each day, each week, as we all know, this is changeable. And our decisions will be based on our likes and dislikes. And frankly, when things get tough, then we don't feel like doing it anymore. The vows are really there to hold our feet to the fire when it gets hot, you know, like, they're there because it's going to get difficult at some point. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother to make them. And what is it about a vow that helps us follow through? So a lot of times it's about the concreteness of a statement. It's not just a passing thought. We give it words, or we write it down, or we record it in some way that can't be denied. Oftentimes, vows are publicly witnessed, really formal vows. So other people heard us state, this is what I want to do. Or somebody knows that you are in recovery. So when you reach for that drink, they say, aren't you in recovery? Now, some vows may not be explicitly stated or formalized, but they manifest in our lives as really unalterable commitments that we have. And the deeper the conviction or desire to make our lives accord with our vow, the more powerful and transformative it can be. So I don't know about you, but I've found vows around pretty superficial things like weight loss are often not very helpful. So where it, you know, part of it is matters. Where does the motivation come from? Is it on behalf of others? Is it caring for or appreciating our lives? Is it challenging ourselves? Is it about living our lives to the fullest? I think there's probably people who have made differences in their lives because of vows in a certain sense of seeking power or fame or, you know, money or attractiveness. They probably have achieved something. But of course, is that the shape we want to give to our lives? So life vows that help shape our lives, arise out of this deep conviction or resonance. So many of you may already know, is my video like a mirror image so you can't even read this? You can read it?
Yes, I can read it.
Weird. I can't read it. Okay. So this is Chosen Bay's The Vow-Powered Life. And this is a neat story that she starts off with about her teacher, Maizumi Roshi. So Maizumi Roshi is a good example of vow shaping your life. He left Japan on a steamship at age 26 with a one-way ticket and just a few $100s in spending money. He also carried a vow to plant the Dharma so deeply in American soil that it would thrive and not die out. From the outside, his vow seemed impossible. He did not speak English. He had no means of support beyond the small stipend paid by a Japanese-American temple. By day, he served at the temple and worked as a gardener. By night, he took English classes at a community college. And he sat Zazen. Gradually, a group of Western students came to sit with him, eventually growing into a community that after a few more years bought a small house. Thus, as a result of Maizumi's original vow, the Zen Center of Los Angeles took shape. It grew into a complex of houses and apartment buildings that occupied almost an entire city block, housing 75 residents, a community clinic that was one of the first in the country to integrate Western and Eastern healing methods, and an academic institution that sponsored conferences and publications by Buddhist scholars. Out of that busy center came a lineage that includes more than 100 authorized Zen teachers serving thousands of students in over 60 Zen centers around the world, all from what might have seemed a foolish vow taken on with great sincerity by a determined young man. So Chosen does a really good job of pointing out in her book that there's those examples of very dramatic vows, you know, like doing something grand and making something happen. But that all of us already have lots of vows that we're living out. We may be aware of them or not. So she has a nice chapter in a book about kind of finding the vows that are present in your life already. So these, of course, can be marriage vows that we've made out of love, commitment to a person, or determination to form a stable family unit to raise and nurture children. Many of us have a vow, perhaps unstated but strong, to be there for our families, our children, aging parents, perhaps also siblings and extended family members. We might really have a deep commitment to being there for certain friends for whom we feel a lasting connection and commitment, that being friends with them is not just about, you know, having fun on the weekends or a pleasant conversation now and then, but that it's a really committed friendship. We may be committed to exploring our existence through artistic expression, a particular kind of expression. Or speaking the truth as we see it, no matter the cost. Standing up for anyone who we see being excluded or abused. Dedicating ourselves to sharing the power and joy of education or literacy. Commitment to sobriety, refraining from drugs or alcohol. Refraining from eating meat or animal products out of concern for animal welfare, ecological concerns. Exploring, practicing, honing, teaching a skill or art because of your love and appreciation for its beauty, what it has to teach. So Chosen suggests looking at your life, looking at the choices you have made, that you're not the ones you regret, but the choices that you're glad you made, or are even proud of, or at your accomplishments, and then think about the underlying vow behind them. You know, the deeper motivation, the deeper reason for them. And this is a way of kind of examining the vows that are already present in your life. So I was hoping that people would mind taking a minute, perhaps getting a piece of paper and jotting down some of the vows you have explicitly made or that are manifested in your life through your choices, commitments, or accomplishments, or just review them mentally. So give us about a minute and then put us into breakout rooms where you can share if you're willing. Otherwise, just, you know, just listen and just say pass if you don't feel like sharing. So just give us a minute to reflect. All right, I will invite you to rooms.
Good question, Domyo.
One room must have been having a really great conversation. They're not coming back to the last minute. Okay. My vows as I'm as my priest vows, there's a specific set of them, but essentially I sum it up as serving the three treasures: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I'm married. I have marriage vows. Primarily, I think it's about sharing. We didn't have children together, so it's about sharing our lives, sharing our resources, sharing support. And my husband thought of adding one about humor, dealing with one another with a sense of humor. I established and served Bright Way Zen. And I haven't made a formal vow, but I've said it out loud before that I want this community to be here 100 years from now, to be available for way-seeking minds in this area. I feel like I kind of have a personal passion for speaking the truth as I see it, even if doing so is unpopular or has a cost. I don't really care. I mean, I don't like conflict, but if I see something, I'm going to say it, whether it pisses somebody off or I get canceled or whatever. I did take a vow out of Great Vow. They have a shrine of vows, so you can write a vow on a piece of wood or a tile or something and kind of just go hang it out in this shrine of vows. So I have one hanging out there that says, I will live each day as if it is my last. And then recently I really I'm going to do everything I can to prevent the breakdown of our planet's natural life support systems, not stopping as long as one being can be saved. So that one of the things we talked about in our room is that kind of, you know, there's this process of looking to your life and seeing what vows are already there, what's already manifesting. But also, if you want to give your life more shape or direction, what do you commit yourself to, right? There's so many things that you could commit yourself to. So kind of discerning what is yours to do, what really calls to you, what are you good at, what are you in the right place to do. So it's quite an art. And then I wanted to just wrap up by pointing out how our Buddhist vows are often, perhaps usually, impossible. So, as many of you know, the Mahayana Bodhisattva vows, our beings are numberless, I vow to free them. And we usually don't include in that all, but that's implied, right? Beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them all. If they're boundless, how do you even enter them? The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. I vow to realize and complete and embody it. So, I mean, by their very nature, these vows are stated to be impossible. And then we have our precept vows, which even in their concrete form are tricky, right? Do not indulge anger, cultivate equanimity. Even that, you know, we know is challenging. But even within the Kyoju Kaimon, which is our scripture on the precepts, there's a way of phrasing the precepts which are, it's impossible to keep them, right? So the three pure precepts are cease from harm, release all self-attachment. All self-attachment. Do only good, take selfless action. So do only good. All day, every day, do only good. Do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. And then when you get into the grave precepts, there's a statement, these are called the Bodhidharma precepts. And I think they're really beautiful. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. So no thought of cutting something off, rejecting it. No thought even arising of that. In the realm of the unattainable Dharma, holding no thought of gain is the precept of not stealing. In the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. Every word we speak is in some way incomplete, in some way does not fully capture the truth. And yet we have to speak. In the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusions is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. Harbor no delusions. I mean, how do you even know, perhaps, sometimes if you're deluded? So what is the value of such vows? I'll kind of throw that question out, and we'll have a few minutes to talk about it. But I wanted to share something that a couple words from Shohaku Okumura, and this is Living by Vow, and a number of you have appreciated this book already. So Okumura takes us through the four bodhisattva vows, the refuges, our meal chants, the Heart Sutra, various kind of scriptures and vows that are a big part of Zen, and he talks about them in a very accessible way. So first of all, I thought this was an important thing to note. It says, a life led by vow is a life animated or inspired by vow, not one that is watched, scolded, or consoled by vow. These verbs create a separation between the person and the vow. The simple phrase, living by vow, emphasizes that the person and the vow are one. Our life is itself a vow. And then in terms of the vows being impossible, he says we shouldn't compare our practice, our understanding, or our achievements with those of other people. When we do, we become competitive. We think, I'm better than them, or I'm practicing harder. Our practice becomes a competition based on egocentricity, something totally meaningless as a practice of the Buddha's way. We cannot peacefully settle down into such a competitive practice. No matter how hard or long we practice, if our practice is based on ego, we are totally deluded. Such practice leads to a selfish view, arrogance, and self-attachment. Even though we think we are practicing the Dharma, we are against the Dharma completely. However, when we understand that our goal is eternal, infinite, and absolute, no matter how hard we practice, no matter how many things we master, no matter how deep our understanding of Buddha's teachings, compared to the infinite, we are zero. We cannot afford to be arrogant. There is another side to this. Even if we cannot practice as hard, sit as long, study as much, or understand as deeply as others, we don't need to feel guilty or inferior. Compared to the eternal, the absolute, or the infinite, we're all equal to zero. There is something deeply meaningful in our comparison with the absolute. Understanding ourselves in this way frees our practice from competition based on selfishness. So sometimes I like to think about, you know, what if these vows were like, what if there was an achievable limit on them? Beings are numberless. I vow to free three of them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end 30% of them. You know, there would just be like this is about a direction that we're moving, not a, you know, a goal, an end place that we're going to arrive and be satisfied with. So with that, I'll open up for a few comments and questions. Just go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something you want to say.
Well, my friend Jason had a baby. His wife had a baby a couple of years ago, and I would call and I would say, "How's the baby?" And he'd say, "Well, he's alive. He's still alive." And he said, "My job is to keep this baby alive." And so we always, the whole joke, every time I ask him, "How's your son?" It's like, "Oh, he's alive. So I'm doing my job." So he does, it's not like he's vowing to, "I'm going to feed him and I'm going to bathe him and I'm going to take him to the doctor." You don't have to do all those little individual vows. He's just like, "My job, keep baby alive. That's it." And then all those other things fall into place. So why not go big?
Yeah.
Have a big one.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that I prefer, and in the Nine Fields group, that's where I've used this word instead of vow, is I like the word intention. Because vow just feels too, well, first of all, to me anyway, it feels old-fashioned. You know, it feels like, to riff off what you just said, it feels like 100% of the time I will do this, this, and this. And yeah, I've just, that's unrealistic to me. So, but it is honest to me anyway, by saying it's my intention. You know, I fell short, you know, in my own eye, not because someone tried to impose this on me, but it's my own of my own free will, I have this intention. And I feel like it's riding your bicycle on the road, you know. It's nice and smooth while you've got this intention of staying on the road. You get off the road, it gets bumpy. It's not, that's been my experience anyway, when I've not kept those intentions. So yeah, that's my bit.
Yeah, I find I'll use the word vow, but then sometimes Kyogen would said, when you have an intention, an equal and opposite intention arises, it's like a law of physics. It's like the part of you that doesn't want to do that also arises just as soon as you have that intention. I'm not going to eat that piece of cake. I want to eat that piece of cake. I mean, it's so sometimes I found it helpful to say, I want to do this. I want to be more compassionate. I want to take better care of my body or something like that. But like, hey, look, nobody's, you know, making you do this. This is about what you actually want in a deeper way. Other ways your lives have been shaped by vow. Is there at some point in your life a decision that you made that basically changed everything from there on out?
When I was in my early 20s, I discovered a book called Psycho-Cybernetics, which some people might be familiar with. And it was the first time I realized that I had a choice around my behavior. I had come from a pretty dysfunctional family with a lot of anger and acting out with that. And when I read that book and I got the idea, wow, I don't have to just do whatever I'm doing. I can actually think about it and make a choice. And that, I'll never forget that. That's changed my whole life. So I'd probably be dead if I hadn't figured that out. So
what's that, making a choice? No, I quit drinking alcohol and using drugs 18 years ago. And I didn't make a vow of sobriety. I made a vow to choose sobriety on a daily basis. And so it's something that we can choose to pick up. Any one of these vows we can choose to pick up day by day, moment by moment. I made a vow. This is my second marriage. You know, it took a lot of deliberation and thought to get out of the first vow. So, you know, if you're going to break a vow, you have to, that's serious, then you have to really think about it deeply. But, you know, my life sure changed making my vow to my current husband. So, and I fully expect him to be, for us to, well, we're already kind of growing old together and falling apart, but I expect to grow old with that sweet guy.
Well, and it strikes me too, Saon, that you had, I mean, and we don't think of these as like usually like a vow, but in this sense, like you had a vow to Zuma.
Yeah.
You adopted this little Quaker parrot, and you had him how long?
27 years.
And the last part of his life, he was like, kind of blind and deaf and had to live in a little fish tank because he couldn't perch on anything, and you had to feed him by hand. And but there's a
it's true.
I nursed a pet rat through, you know, they don't live very long. They don't live that long. But I nursed him through that last moment, and that, like, I don't know, there's something about seeing something through all the way there that, like, that's the kind of person I want to be. Mm. You know?
I realized I didn't make the vow initially, but I was pregnant at high school graduation, married my childhood sweetheart, and had a baby. And after we only stayed married for about 2 years, and then I moved on, but I was found myself a single parent, and I needed an education, so I was going to college, and it was very difficult to do everything. Like, I could never take more than 12 or 15 hours because I had to be home at night to make dinner and read a story and do the bath and all that kind of stuff. And at one point I thought, I really don't want to do this anymore. And then I thought, well, that's not going to work out very well. So I made a deal with myself to stick it out one more year. And then on the same day next year, I could think about if I was going to not do it anymore, what I was, you know, how I was going to see that she was taken care of. And that got me through about 5 years. And then I didn't need to do it anymore. But I think having a baby at 18 is probably too young.
Wow. Any last thoughts? Well, let's witness some vows later on this afternoon. Oh, and I don't have a bell, but we can still do the dedication. We dedicate the merit of this practice to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to everybody who's working on the Jukai ceremony.
Yay. See y'all in a couple hours.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's already, wow. All right. Take care.